In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is The Guardian.
Trump-like proposals to enable, again, the immigration minister to literally blacklist countries without any review, without any parliamentary oversight.
Do you agree with your deputy leader in describing that provision as racist?
I don't know how else you can describe both elements of this bill other than being systemically racist.
Hello, I'm Paul Karp, Guardian Australia's chief political correspondent, and I'm coming to you from Ngunnawal and Ngambri country. This week, the government opened the door to working with the Greens on the religious discrimination bill, but when they went to the coalition for support on a new hardline bill to facilitate deportation of non-citizens, they came up short. I'm speaking with Senator David Shoebridge, the Greens' justice spokesperson, who was just on Monday appointed to the Home Affairs and Immigration portfolio. He has insight into both the deportation bill and religious discrimination, and we also discuss the latest twist in the Julian Assange extradition case. Welcome, Senator Shoebridge.
Yeah, cheers, Paul. Good to be here.
Now, you were made Greens immigration spokesperson on Monday. Could you tell us, please, what was behind the Greens reshuffle? And were you ready to be thrown into the deep end with a rushed government deportation bill on the Tuesday?
Yeah, it could have been Monday week, couldn't it? So what was behind was Senator Janet Rice is retiring. And with that comes an inevitable modest portfolio reshuffle. And just in the course of that portfolio reshuffle, it became sensible for me to pick up the Home Affairs, Immigration and Refugee portfolio. It's an area I've been very passionate about, one of the core reasons I joined the party. There's a real affinity between my office and this work, and we were very glad to take it on board. That being said, we were surprised to find on day two, we were suddenly thrown into the extent of the policy debate we had. But, you know, we're looking forward to doing that work. We're hoping to push back against what we think may well be some pretty ugly elements of that debate in the lead up to the federal election and keen to do that work with communities.
Mm. I understand there are a lot of concerns about the process that the government has gone through with its migration amendment removal and other measures bill. But if we could start with what your biggest substantive concern is with how this bill would work if passed.
Yeah, so dealing with the substance of the bill, and remember, we've only really had it. It feels like forever, but we've only really had it for 3 days. It puts in place these new extraordinary powers, or it proposes these new extraordinary powers for the minister to effectively compel people to undertake actions, anyone who's a non-citizen, and indeed anyone who's a non-citizen on pretty much any visa, depending on how broadly the government wants to extend the powers by regulations, to compel them to undertake certain actions. It's said to be focused on compelling people who are on what the government calls a removal pathway, people who have had an asylum or refugee claim denied by a very unfair system, to compel them to do things such as apply for a passport in their home country. And then if they don't follow the direction and apply for and obtain a passport in their home country, that's an offence. There's literally no defence to that offence, and there's a mandatory minimum jail term of 12 months and a maximum jail term of 5 years if you don't comply with the direction. It's utterly cruel, and you know, we see it being played out with communities such as the Iranian community. A mum may be refusing to sign passport application for her and her kids to be returned to Iran. She may believe she has a well-founded fear of persecution. And if that claim has been rejected by the unfair immigration assessment system, of course, there's no merits appeal to a court. If that's rejected, the ministers then can issue with a direction. And if mum refuses to sign for a passport and see her family return to persecution in Iran, she goes to jail for a minimum 12 months. It's a fairly extraordinary, it's a kind of extreme power that even the coalition hadn't reached for. And then the second element in the bill are these kind of Trump-like proposals to enable, again, the immigration minister to literally blacklist countries through a determination that's not even reviewable in parliament to determine that countries, and again, we're talking at least from the list the government has used, starting with Iran and Russia and South Sudan, to blacklist a country. And once that happens, the department is prohibited from processing visas from that country. And so that would mean diaspora communities literally being cut off from their parents, from their brothers and their sisters and their families without any review, without any parliamentary oversight. You know, I'm a Green senator. We have a long history of advocating for a fair and humane system. These two core provisions of this bill are deeply offensive.
Do you agree with your deputy leader in describing that provision as racist?
I don't know how else you can describe both elements of this bill other than being systemically racist. You know, I think we know the communities where this is going to be targeted against, and it's almost certainly not the UK and the US.
I mean, arguably, countries are designated because of the fact that they don't cooperate in taking deportations from Australia. Did you accept any of that material that they think that they could use this as a sort of bargaining chip to improve the cooperation between countries?
I think we need to be clear what the bargaining chip is. The bargaining chip isn't something between the Albanese government and the regime in Iran, the brutal and dictatorial regime in Iran. The bargaining chip is the movement of peoples between Iran and Australia. It's the movement of families, the connection of families. That's what the Albanese government is using as a bargaining chip, a prospect of literally severing that lifeline, that connection between diaspora groups here in Australia. And, you know, it may start with Iran and Russia and South Sudan, but it could extend to any other diaspora group. And so, you know, to hold those communities at ransom because of the crimes of their government or the failings of their government is appalling public policy. And indeed, one of the reasons why Senator Faruqi described this as a racist attack.
And I want to go back to the powers to compel unlawful non-citizens to take steps to facilitate their own deportation. You had 2 hours with Home Affairs officials on Tuesday evening. What were you able to find out about who this affects, how many people, and why the government wants this power?
So not surprisingly, when the government is bringing legislation to Parliament and says it's so urgent that it has to be approved within 36 hours, the first question that I asked, and I think other senators asked of Home Affairs, was, well, why is it urgent and who's it going to apply to? Now, they had no credible explanation to the first, but on this question of who it will apply to, you would have thought that they would have had a clear answer. Their response was, well, it applies to 150 people in immigration detention. And so the obvious question from that is, well, why is it urgent, you know, in a matter of days rather than weeks, to get legislation to deport people who are already in immigration detention? No explanation given. They said it will also apply to people who are on visas following the High Court decision of last year, some 152 people on those visas. When we asked, well, in what way and how will it apply? They said, oh, well, they'll have to investigate it on a case-by-case basis. They haven't begun doing that. And it may apply to some and it may not apply to others, but that'd be a matter that they'd go through on a case-by-case basis. We said again, well, how is that urgent? And then the third class of visa holders is anyone on a sort of generic bridging visa. When we asked how many people were on those generic bridging visas, the department was unable to tell us whether it was thousands or tens of thousands. When we asked what categories of people on that visa would be targeted, they said they didn't know. And we said, well, how could that possibly be urgent if you don't even know the categories of people you're wishing to apply it to? And again, we had no credible answer. And then there's an additional power in that part of the bill which allows those ministerial direction orders to be expanded to any visa class. And we said, well, what visa classes are you intending to extend it to? on the face of it, could be any visa class. They said, yes, it could be any visa class. And we don't know. We're just, I think the words were future-proofing the legislation. I've rarely seen a worse performance from a poorly briefed minister and a department in a public hearing like that. It was so woefully undercooked. The only conclusion I could take from it was, well, they're trying to dress up an urgency case because this is really a political ploy. There is no substance behind this, no coherent substance behind it.
Hmm. There are some safeguards. The government says that it will only be for people who've exhausted legal appeals, and those found to be refugees won't have to go back to or cooperate with authorities from their country of persecution. Are those insufficient? And can I get your response to their argument that it's fair enough that there's no right to be in Australia, that you then have to cooperate with efforts to remove you?
Well, those safeguards are extraordinarily minimal. First of all, on the point the government says that people have to have exhausted all their legal remedies, that's not in the bill. There's no provision that says that in the bill. The government is assuming that people will be exhausting their legal remedies. But of course, many legal remedies in the refugee space are incredibly limited. Non-discretionary time limits, sometimes only 3 days or 7 days to seek a review or an appeal from a determination. If you miss that, bang, you lose your rights. And whenever you get it to a court, the court's not allowed to look at the merits of whether or not someone should or shouldn't be in receipt of an asylum claim. The court's only allowed to look at any legal technicality in the process. So they're hardly protections in a system that even the Albanese government recognises is so unfair that they're intending to reform it. You know, really unfair parts of the system, such as the IAA fast-track refusals process, the government has got a bill before Parliament to abolish it because they recognise how unfair it is. Yet they're willing to have these incredibly draconian powers exercised against people who have had their asylum claims refused by that unfair process that they want to abolish. So those aren't really protections. And in fact, as I was looking more closely at the legislation in the last 24 hours, there's a further power in there for the minister to revisit a positive asylum finding. So, in fact, there's a power in the bill for the minister to overturn a prior grant of asylum and then to use the powers. So even people who have got have had a determination that they are entitled to protection, this bill even raises questions about that with fresh ministerial powers to overturn that.
Is that reviewable? Can a court trump that then? Or
no, it's not reviewable. It's a bare ministerial power, exercise of ministerial discretion. The only review would be on jurisdictional error if there was some procedural failing made by the minister.
The Greens teamed up with the Coalition for a six-week inquiry into this bill. Labor accused you both of weaponising it for your own ends. I want to ask if you want to respond to that. And secondly, you know, when Nick McKim was in your role, the Greens refused to cooperate with the Coalition to set up a broader inquiry into the government's handling of the NZYQ High Court case because of fears that they would weaponise that inquiry to demonise asylum seekers and refugees. So I wanted to ask, you know, what guardrails you have around working with the Coalition on this issue?
Well, I don't presume that the Coalition are coming to this from the same principled base that the Greens do. We want a humane and just refugee and asylum seeker policy that's compliant with our international legal obligations. The Coalition doesn't. But in this case, when we have a bill that is being literally tried to be rammed through the Parliament within 36 hours... when we found out again in that hearing that there'd been no external consultation prior to the bill being introduced, literally no stakeholder had had a look at it, let alone legal experts, and when under a very modest scrutiny, we had a rushed two-hour hearing, we could identify so many potential defects and loopholes and issues with the bill, I think even the Coalition realised that they couldn't in good conscience just rush it through. You know, whether or not that ends up being the Coalition been uncomfortable with the extraordinary powers and the vicious attacks that are contained in the bill after an inquiry, I can't speculate on. That's a matter for the Coalition. But we'll work with anybody in the Parliament to put this kind of legislation under scrutiny, to test it for the flaws and the unforeseen consequences in it and hopefully defeat it over the next 6 weeks. And, you know, we moved the motion to refer it off to an inquiry and the Coalition supported it. That's actually what a Senate should do. And I think it functioned, that part of the Senate, despite the government's efforts, actually functioned And I think we welcome the Senate functioning as a proper House of Review.
Will you be offering or making amendments to this bill, or do you think it's irredeemable?
Well, thankfully, now we have a six-week inquiry. You know, often we are caught in a situation where there's a fairly brutal attack happening against nature or refugees or fairness, and we see the Coalition and Labor joining together on the core unfairness or the core attack, but we're able to limit some of the damage by negotiating amendments. And you know, we don't rule out doing that in a bill like this, but our principal position at this point is to do everything we can to defeat it. I don't see how these kinds of powers attached to mandatory minimum jail sentences, this blacklisting of foreign countries, this potential break with diaspora communities and their families across the globe, standing here now, I don't see how it's redeemable. But, you know, we do the best we can with the hand we're dealt in that place. And I don't rule out, if we can't kill it, seeking to minimise the damage through amendment.
The Prime Minister told Labor's party room this week that there are two paths to pass religious discrimination bills through the Coalition or the Greens and Crossbench. Since then, we've seen some religious stakeholders, including the National Catholic Education Commission, warn against the government going down the crossbench path. Do you think that the Prime Minister is fair dinkum about the possibility of working with you on this?
Well, I hope he's fair dinkum, because we've said very clearly we're willing to work across the aisle in order to implement the outcome that the Australian Law Reform Commission proposed. And we're not going to be dogmatic in how we do that. We're willing to work within those set of principles to achieve an outcome that, you know, protects LGBTIQ kids going to school, stops trans and queer kids facing discrimination and exclusion when they're at school, but also puts in the protections that the Law Reform Commission thought were appropriate for faith-based institutions. And we've also had a long-standing commitment to support a balanced set of religious anti-vilification laws. There's clearly a capacity for Labor to come and work with us on getting a package through. But when the Prime Minister says that to his caucus and then repeats it in one way or another to the media, that he's willing to work with the Greens and the Coalition, but he only gives the Coalition a copy of the bill and has refused so far to give the Greens a copy of the bill, and including in a meeting that myself and Adam Bandt had with the Attorney General earlier this week, I think that does call into question his bona fides. But from our side of the record, we're not interested in kind of, you know, petty history to that effect. Share us a copy of the bill. We're willing to work in good faith and achieve an outcome, you know, that implements the principles set out by the Law Reform Commission.
Now, we know generally that the government bill removes the religious schools exemption to the Sex Discrimination Act in Section 38 to protect queer students and teachers, but then it puts something back in to the new religious discrimination bill to ensure that the hiring of teachers can be in line with the religious ethos of a school, which many advocates fear is a backdoor for discrimination. So based on that briefing that you received, are you able to say whether the Labor proposal is more or less protective of religious institutions' right to discriminate than the ALRC report is?
Well, I mean, we haven't seen the drafting. That's what we've repeatedly said to Labor. If you want us to fairly assess your proposal, show us the drafting. If it's as you described, as bald, in the bald fashion that you described, then it does appear to be a shade less protective of teachers and, in particular, than the recommendation in the Law Reform Commission. But again, you know, with complex anti-discrimination law, the devil really is in the detail and looking at how that protection is crafted. The assurances we got from the government was, to the extent you can have assurances without a copy of the bill, was that the exclusion only applied at the moment of hiring. And, you know, that is at least a constraint on the exclusion. But again, you know, it's a bit hard to speculate on it in the absence of a copy of the bill.
On Tuesday, Julian Assange was handed a reprieve in his fight against extradition to the US after two judges ruled the WikiLeaks founder may be able to take his case to an appeal hearing. But first, the US government has 3 weeks to offer assurances to allay judges' concerns about the fairness of that process. What sort of assurances from the US would be adequate in your view?
Well, if you look at the history of some other extraditions, these were raised by the Assange camp in the hearing, the US has an uncomfortable history of offering certain assurances and then not delivering on them once somebody's returned extradited onto US shores. You know, at a minimum, the assurances being sought from the court are that the death penalty won't be sought to be used against Julian Assange. I find it remarkable. We're now, you know, more than a decade down from this US persecution of Julian Assange, and the prospect of a death penalty is still on the table and hasn't been excluded by the Biden administration. I find that utterly extraordinary. The other protection was that's been sought, the assurance has been sought, is about Julian Assange's rights to free speech. And we have seen in statement after statement from the Biden administration that they do not want to extend First Amendment protections to free speech to non-citizens. They have been quite clear about that. The administration is not of the view that those free speech protections extend to non-citizens. I think many people are watching closely how that the US government will respond to it. But at the end of the day, what the High Court in the UK has done is throw Julian Assange a lifeline. There's a few short weeks now where our government should be doing absolutely everything they can to get the US to drop the prosecution. Or if there's some other solution that the Assange camp is willing to accept, which may see a radical reduction in the charging, to do everything they possibly can to ensure that in these last few weeks, these are the last few weeks Julian Assange is in detention. And at the end of this, we're not going back into court and further detention or extradition, but at the end of this, by hook or by crook, Julian Assange is a free man, so he can live a free life with his wife and his kids. I think, though, that that's going to require the Albanese government to start putting some actual diplomatic assets on the table. And you know, it's pretty clear that cranky letters and public utterances haven't been enough to move the Biden administration by now. Some diplomatic assets should be put on the table.
What exactly should they do?
Well, I mean, one of the obvious things we could do is put a go slow on AUKUS. Perhaps say to the United States, well, you know, Australia has welcomed thousands of Marines into Darwin, B-52s in HMAS Tyndall, and is proposing to extend HMAS Sterling to be a forward-facing US nuclear attack sub base. Perhaps say to the United States, well, we thought you were our friend. This is on the basis of shared values. You're not expressing shared values by trying to persecute Julian Assange. I would like to see that reversed. I think that may be too much to ask. But surely our government could say, well, actually, we're going to put a go slow on this. We're going to reduce our cooperation in these spaces because this actually matters to us.
A go slow might mean we're paying billions of dollars for a nuclear technology uplift in the UK and US for subs we never get. But
we haven't got time for me to express my utter horror at $4.6 billion of Australian money going to the Rolls Royce in the United States, $4.7 billion going to US workforce and a nuclear submarine basis, on top of another $4.5 billion that we gave to the French. Seems to me there's money in AUKUS for everyone but Australians.
Don't worry, Daniel Hurst will have you back on for an AUKUS-themed episode at some point, I'm sure. The government says it's raised Julian Assange's case repeatedly with the US and UK at the highest levels. Last month, the Prime Minister and his cabinet voted for a motion in Parliament calling for him to come home. Do you give Anthony Albanese and the government any credit for going well beyond what the coalition did?
I'm not going to ignore the change. And I think the diplomatic change has been important. And I welcome the people inside the Labor Party who have been driving for this change. And I welcome the resolution that the government joined in on just a few short weeks ago that made it clear that this has gone on too long. And I think that has been a step change in tone. And you know, when I was in Washington last year with a cross-party delegation on the Assange matter, I also saw clearly that Ambassador Rudd had been working consistently on it. And, you know, it'd be churlish not to recognise that. And I think it's been important. And it's one of the reasons why the Australian public and the global public is actually more engaged on this issue than it's ever been before. But it doesn't seem to have been enough. And I think that's the key point. And this is why I say some diplomatic assets should be put on the table, because there has been that step change, hasn't been enough. And the language has always still been limited. And I think the phrase used by the Prime Minister is this has gone on too long, which kind of doesn't address the fundamental problem here, that no Australian journalist should be being prosecuted for the sharing of US secrets that expose war crimes when they weren't in the US. They're not a US citizen. They're not covered by any obligation of secrecy to the United States. And that should never be applied against any Australian citizen outside of the United States. And you know, the threat that has, not just to Australian citizens, but to independent journalism, you know, hasn't been addressed by our government, and I think should be addressed.
One last question on whistleblowers. You're one of David McBride's biggest defenders and have heaped pressure on Mark Dreyfus to drop the prosecution against him. How do you reflect on the public discourse about McBride's motives, the suggestion they're not as portrayed at the time? Does that matter?
Well, I think the first thing is, you know, I consider David to be a friend. I've been with him on this struggle for some time now, and you don't necessarily agree with all the politics of your friends, but I think he's a very decent person and is acting on his own set of principles. And I might criticise some of what drives his principles. I may have different political views than him. But our whistleblowing laws are not designed to protect someone's moral purity or their lack of, you know, any kind of motivation that you might want to criticise. The whistleblower laws are there to allow the public to hear evidence of potential crimes or wrongdoings of the public, and to try, as I think the prosecution in the McBride case has had, to demonise David McBride, to try and destroy his character, and through that somehow delegitimise what he did, which was bring to the attention of the Australian public for the first time ever, potentially dozens and dozens of war crimes committed by Australian troops in Afghanistan, has been pretty awful to watch. It doesn't matter the motivations of a whistleblower. What matters here is opening up a chain of communication between people who can see crimes and wrongdoings by the government and the public, when the usual chains of accountability have shut them down. So this vicious attack on David's character utterly misses the purpose for our whistleblowing laws, and I think it's pretty venal.
That's all we have time for. Thank you very much for joining us, Senator Shoebridge.
Pleasure speaking, Paul.
This episode was produced by Miles Herbert. The executive producer is Miles Martignoni. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How can a people-first approach to higher education transformation improve success? An EY report suggests that taking emotional and psychological factors into account is just as important as the technology. Six factors drive this human-centered approach: leadership, inspiration, care, empowerment, investment, and collaboration. Get these right, and they can more than double an organization's chance of transformation success. Learn more about people-first transformation at theguardian.com/transforminghighereducation. This message was paid for by EY.